Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
A very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, No Peace Without Prayer. That's the title of Abbot Timothy Wright's new book focusing on Christian-Muslim dialogue. Of choirs in the Vatican's Cappella Giulia for its 50th anniversary. But first, Rio de Janeiro is about to welcome the first ever Latin American Pope. Pope Francis will touch down there on Monday 22nd of July to attend World Youth Day, a journey marking Papa Francesco's first foreign trip. Brazil has the largest Catholic community in Latin America, and Rio is its second largest city. Travelling with the Pope throughout this journey, which ends on July the 28th, is the head of the English programme here at Vatican Radio, Sean Patrick Lovett. I sat down with him here in our studios before his departure. Let's listen to what he told me. So, Sean, you're off again to another World Youth Day with a different pope this time. Which pope is this? Your third, I think.
This is my fifth pope. I started here with Paul VI. So Paul VI, John Paul I, John Paul II, Benedict XVI, Francis, there you go, five.
But World Youth Day, only three of these popes.
Because they were begun by John Paul II, exactly. And I was at the first World Youth Day, which, if you like connections, was in Buenos Aires. And it was 1987, 26 years ago. We were all much more beautiful and younger.
Well, we do like connections. And it's strange how Benedict XVI went on his first journey abroad. He attended World Youth Day in his own country, Germany. And this pope is attending World Youth Day as his first journey abroad in Latin America, not in Buenos Aires, but in Brazil.
And another connection to add to that connection is the fact that Benedict XVI inherited the Cologne World Youth Day from John Paul II. It had been organized by John Paul II, and Benedict XVI went, and Francis is inheriting the Rio World Youth Day, which was organized for Benedict XVI.
These World Youth Days are very similar. The events are very similar, aren't they?
There's almost a format now, isn't there? If you think of the Pope hearing confessions, the Pope participating at the Way of the Cross, the vigil with the young people, the dialogue with the young people and the Mass. Yes, it does sort of have a format by now. The lunch with the young people, these fixed events that are part of the World Youth Day scheme.
The lunch with the young people you talked about is quite interesting because the young people are going to be from all five continents.
All five continents, and then a couple of young people specifically from Brazil because it's the host country. And the exciting thing, of course, is that it's a private meeting. There are no cameras, there are no microphones allowed. It's a privileged conversation between the Pope and these young people around a lunch table.
Has Pope Francis added anything to the schedule?
He himself requested the visit to Our Lady of Aparecida. He made it clear from the beginning that he wanted to visit Our Lady, and he wanted to do so the same way as he visited the shrine of Our Lady here in Rome at Santa Maria Maggiore the day after his election.
Which was a private visit.
I think his idea was that he could make a private visit to Aparecida as well. But of course, that's impossible. There are going to be about 20,000 people inside the cathedral when he's saying Mass and at least 100,000 outside when he steps outside to greet them.
In your opinion, what are going to be some of the highlights of this visit of Pope Francis to Brazil?
The official highlights, of course, are they're three. It's the Way of the Cross, which will be very spectacular. It'll be along the
all
beach.
All of them in Rio, no?
All of them in Rio. Everything is totally concentrated on Rio. Rio is already a complicated enough city to have to move around in, so they're all concentrated there in the greater metropolitan area. So you have the Way of the Cross on the beach of Copacabana and the vigil with the young people and then, of course, the Mass as well, that closes the World Youth Day and announces the next one. Those are the three official major events, shall we say. But, since you asked the question, personally I think more interesting are the smaller events that will be taking place. The fact that Pope Francis, another thing he specifically asked for was to visit the favela, the slum. And not only will he be visiting the slum, but he'll be spending time in someone's house, drinking probably a mate with them in their house.
But these people don't know.
They don't know big word because they themselves are being protected from the media. If the media knew, you can imagine. And you like connections just as much as I do. So allow me to remind listeners and readers that when John Paul II visited Latin America in 1980, he too asked to visit a slum, and it was the slum of Vidigal, and he took off his gold ring and gave it to the people in the slum, and it's kept in a museum there to this day. So there again, there are these connections.
Which is perhaps not what he wanted, but anyway.
I don't think probably not, but there you go. You can understand a human. They would want to keep that as something very special. And then the fact that he's visiting the hospital of St. Francis, and there's a lovely connection there. And he's meeting with, again, young people are the key to everything. So he's meeting young people who are involved in drug rehabilitation programs or alcohol abuse rehabilitation programs. And the fact that he's meeting prisoners, he can't go to them, so they're bringing the prisoners to him. The fact that he's going to be hearing confessions, it seems to me these more personal moments, more private, more personal moments, are to me personally what add interest and colour to this event.
And of course, Pope Francis loves crowds and crowds love him. But he's not going to travel around in a Pope Mobile, is that correct?
And that, yes, you know, we say so quite glibly. I was speaking to someone just today and they were saying, as people often say when they know that we work here at Vatican Radio, how wonderful Pope Francis is and he's so much fun. And I say, yes, looking at him from the outside in, I suppose that he does seem like a lot of fun. But living with him and working with him from the inside out isn't exactly fun. I mean, the people who are dealing with the security there, it's not funny at all. Of course, one respects his desire to be able to be in contact with people, but he himself, as you know, has asked to use the same open jeep that he uses in St. Peter's Square because he needs to be in contact with people, and it's a very beautiful thing, but I'm also very glad that I'm not responsible for security.
It's kind of worrying, isn't it? He has this very personal style and he's added some new touches to the journey itself, hasn't he?
The most striking of which is the fact that he wants to meet the foreign press corps one by one. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised
because that's
very much his style. You mentioned John Paul II. John Paul II invented the so-called impromptu press conferences in flight. And of course, after 26 years, he knew everybody by name. And so it was, oh, hi, Veronica. And, you know, so how's Vatican Radio doing and whatever. And it was all very, very intimate and very improvised. Benedict XVI wanted to continue that, but it was more structured. Father Lombardi would take the questions and then refer them to Pope Benedict and he would respond. Pope Francis has his own style again and wants to walk down the aisle and shake hands and meet with each of the journalists accredited to the papal flight. And that'll be new again. We'll see what happens. And since you ask, there is one more point, since I don't know what people have been reading in other countries, but here in Italy there's been a lot of coverage given to the papal bed in the flight that's going to take him to Rio. Apparently there never was a papal bed. This I have from the organizer of the papal visits himself, Alberto Gasparri, our colleague. It never was a question of a bed. The seats in the plane that take the Pope are just like beds anyway, so the Pope didn't have to either ask for or deny having one. The beds that are already available are good enough, suitable enough for his needs.
Where will he be staying? Because there's no nunciature in Rio, because
right.
It's not capital. I mean, Brasilia is the capital.
Indeed, the nunciature is in Brasilia. He'll be staying in a religious house on one of the hills overlooking Rio. It's very, very beautiful. Apparently it has a gorgeous garden around it. So it's a sort of retreat. That's where he'll be staying on Tuesday, his day off, the day that's been fitted into the schedule to give him a moment to relax and catch his breath.
Of course, we have no doubt that he'll charm the young people. But more broadly, this will be an insight for us into the pontificate itself, into the Francis style, won't it?
It's something new, but it's something new for us. It's something new for him as well. Apparently, it's the biggest secret around right now, so don't tell anybody. But this is his first youth day, but not just as Pope, but as Bergoglio. He's never been to a youth day ever. So it's going to be a brand new experience for him as much as it is for us.
So we'll have a good time out there covering for this unexpected pontificate with the Pope of Surprises.
Well,
it's going to be tough, Sean.
It's going to be challenging, shall we say, but let's hope that we're up to the challenge.
And that was Sean Patrick Lavett, who will be reporting for us on World Youth Day from Rio de Janeiro. Meanwhile, here in the Vatican, the combined cathedral and chamber choirs of St. Colman's Cathedral, Colb, are to sing at a special Mass for Pope Francis in St. Peter's Basilica on Sunday, 21st of July, a contribution to the fifth centennial of the Cappella Julia. In an effort to find out more, Lydia O'Kane speaks to the choir master, Dominic Finn.
Your choir is over here in Rome for the celebrations of the Cappella Julia Choir, the famous Cappella Julia Choir here in the Vatican that's celebrating its 500th anniversary. It was founded by Julius II in 1513. Tell me, how did this invitation come about?
It transpired that we sang a Mass in July 2009. And it was a great experience, but we never realised, you know, whether we did sung the Mass well, or whether it was a disaster, or how was it perceived. And then 2 years later, we were at rehearsals one Wednesday night, and I had a missed call from Rome. And I said, oh my God, what's this? I saw the number come up. So I ran home, and I had a message on the phone from Father Pierre. So he rang me, explained about the 500th anniversary coming up in 2013, and he extended the invitation then. And what happened then is I came to Rome in February 2012 to meet him and get all the music approved for the Mass, and here we are now going to sing the Mass on this coming Sunday morning.
Obviously, when you're performing at a Mass, music and the choice of music becomes very important. Was that difficult?
Well, I suppose from a music point of view, we're lucky because we sing in a cathedral. We would select music that would be suitable for a big building like that, so I knew that we were on the right track coming to St. Peter's, because again, singing in a big open space, the music that we would generally sing on a weekly basis at home would probably suit here as well. So Father Pierre invited me out. We were here in February last year, and I had to bring all the different types of music that I was going to propose, and he sat down with me and went through the whole list of music, all the options. I brought recordings of them all, gave him a listen, and then he said, yeah, you can have that and you can have that. So it turns out that we're going to do two John Rutter pieces, one entrance and one recessional, and we're going to have the brass players from St. Peter's are going to play with us for that. We also have a piece by an Irish composer, Rona MacDonagh, and we're singing his piece, Fate, Hope and Love, for the offertory. And we came across another composer from Belfast, his name is Philip Stopford. I would describe him as a younger, new generation of John Rutter. And he has written some magnificent music. He was in Cove about 6 months ago doing workshops with us. The choir really liked his music. So at the time, Father Pierre had put down another piece of music for communion. But because at the workshops, we really liked this piece, I sent a message to Father Pierre saying, could we change it to this Philip Stopford piece? It was called Do Not Be Afraid. Father Pierre emailed back saying, can you send me a recording of it? Which I did, straight back, a beautiful piece of music. Certainly you can have that. So Philip Stopford is flying in from Belfast into Rome to come and hear his piece of music being premiered in the St. Peter's Basilica.
You're used to singing in, as you said, a large space, in a cathedral space. Mm-hmm. But tell me, what's it like singing in St. Peter's? Is it a whole different experience?
I suppose we'd have to look at the Mass we did in 2009, which was, I mean, I'd say we all lost about a stone each from nerves. It was very daunting, very tough going. It was in July, so the Cappella Julia were on holidays. So some of the men from the choir, the guys that did the chant, they were there, maybe four or five of those guys, to intone the chant. So we really didn't have another choir there to fall back on. So we were really exposed. And not having sung there before, a lot of the choir thought that maybe we made a mess of it. You know, because we literally came out of St. Peter's, hopped on a bus back to the airport and home. So we couldn't appreciate, I suppose, the Mass that we just sang. So here we are, we're back, and we're certainly going to appreciate it this time. From a space point of view, I've no hesitations this time, absolutely none. You know, they're used to cathedrals full at home.
This, as I said earlier, is an event celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Cappella Julia, a very historic choir here at the Vatican. It's going to be a very auspicious occasion. Bearing that in mind, your choir has been chosen to sing. How does that make you feel?
Very proud. To be proud for, sorry, I know I'm just getting a bit emotional, but It's proud for the people in the choir. It's also proud for Cove as a parish and the diocese. You know, we've had a tough time. The church in Ireland has a tough time over the last few years. So I suppose we're now able to stand up and say, well, this is really what we're about. You know, we're strong, we're united here. So we are representing the country, and it's a huge honour.
And that was Dominic Finn, choir master of St Colman's Cathedral. Finally, on a totally different note, Linda Bordoni is about to bring us an interview with a longtime friend of ours here at the radio, who speaks to us about his new book by the title of No Peace Without Prayer. He's Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright.
No Peace Without Prayer is the title of the soon-to-be-published book by Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright. Father Timothy is an old friend of Vatican Radio and listeners who throughout the years have enjoyed listening to the many interviews and reflections he has produced for the English programme will not be surprised to learn that the subject of his book is Christian-Muslim dialogue. A dedicated scholar and expert in interfaith relations, a man who has travelled the world to meet with, speak with, pray with and exchange ideas with imams and others committed to peace building through dialogue, Timothy Wright, OSB, is beginning yet another journey of commitment to the cause as he leaves Rome to teach at the Benedictine University in Lyle, Chicago, where 25% of the students are Muslim, and there is fertile ground for further research and insight into a new creative approach to peace building. Of course, we will miss Father Timothy, but he has promised to stay in touch and keep us posted. Before his departure, I met with him for the last time at the Pontifical Beda College, where he lived and worked as spiritual director during his time in Rome. Abbot Timothy speaks with optimism and enthusiasm of the new life awaiting him in the USA. He also talks about his ideas and his beliefs that are the seeds for his book and about his vision for a possible future in which Christians and Muslims across the globe will accept their differences and at the same time affirm their similarities in the name of brotherhood and peace.
I came to Rome 7 years ago and started work in the Pontifical Beda College as a spiritual director, thanks to the generosity of the rector, and at the same time was working for the Abbot Primate on Muslim-Benedictine relations. And that led me through 4, 5, 6 years of academic study on the one hand, and then during the vacations, a number of visits to countries where there were Benedictines and Muslims to try and test the waters to see how much interest there was in dialogue and what type of dialogue. And so all that has now come to an end, and I will be leaving the Beda, where I've had 7 very happy years, and moving to the United States. The reason for the move to the United States is really quite simple, because the Abbot Primate now wants me to work with Benedictine communities, particularly those who are in dialogue with Islam or have Muslim communities nearby and seek to get into dialogue, in order to bring the fruits of my research into their way of thinking, into their way of acting, and to encourage them to enter a dialogue, and at a deeper level, to engage in what I call a dialogue of spirituality. Now, these things take time to develop. The work I did in my research, which is an integral part of this new development, is going to be published in August under the title of No Peace Without Prayer, Encouraging Muslims and Christians to Pray Together, a Benedictine Perspective. And the Benedictine perspective is quite important because the thesis was geared specifically to the Benedictine charism. The book is geared to a much broader readership of people who are interested in and have friendly relations with their local Muslim communities and want to get beyond simply the matter of doing things together, ensuring that there is mutual understanding of different customs and different ways of approaching things. So I'm trying to move that dialogue a step further, so both within the monastic tradition and within the Christian tradition. So you might ask and say, well, what justification have you for that we are so totally different? To which my answer quite simply is that the spirituality of the rule of Benedict and the spirituality of Islam are like brother and sister. they were both emerged in a similar environment and had similar origins. What I mean is that the Rule of Benedict emerged from the desert experience of the early monastic tradition, which was mainly eremitical, but it had a spirituality based around the Word of God, based around the repetition of phrases of prayers, particularly the Psalms, and a sense of discipline, etc. Go 140 years after the Rule of Benedict, and you have the revelations to the prophet, again, in a desert environment. And those revelations were made to someone whose memory was A, alive, B, perceptive, and C, well-tuned to remember. And in that memory, each of these revelations, and there were hundreds of them, the prophet brought down to his group and repeated. And in that culture of repetition, eventually emerged the Quran, the voice of God speaking to the prophet through the word. In the Benedictine tradition, the voice of God speaking through the scriptures in the word. And it is in that spirituality of the word that there is a relationship. I call it brother and sister. There are, of course, other elements within the Rule of Benedict which echo the disciplines of the Muslim way of life, of simplicity of lifestyle, of generosity, of giving, of learning to care for the other, of seeing in the other the presence of God, whoever that other is, offering hospitality, etc. And within that framework, there is the possibility, therefore, of creating a new style of dialogue. I call it the dialogue of spirituality. But a dialogue of spirituality which has a very particular end in view. This particular end in view is to try and create something quite new in the dialogue. At the moment, if you talk to any Muslim people, they will tell you that the Western world, which they see as a Christian world, is a world of violence. The Christian armies, the militarism that accompanies many so-called Christian countries. Leave aside the fact that most of them would call themselves secular now. As far as many Muslims are concerned, they are religious. They have military chaplains who are Christians, and there are many Christians, practicing good Christians, who are members of those armies. On the other side, you have many Muslims for whom this Western side is a threat. And so you get the militancy, the power, the destruction, the violence. And at the moment, the dialogue between the two hardly exists. And in some cases, when you listen to the both sides, they're not even listening to each other. Is there another route, is the question I ask. And through my Benedictine experience and through my experience of the spirituality of Islam, what I am trying to suggest is that a detailed examination of the two sacred texts shows that many of the figures in the Christian tradition, Adam, Noah, Joseph, Abraham, Moses, to name five, Jesus, Mary, are echoed in the Quran, and echoed positively in the Quran. Not the same exactly, but there are similarities. And you put that truth together, the fact of those two elements, and you say, as we ponder our sacred scriptures, the Muslims are the Quran, the Christians the Bible, so we get insights coming to us as we listen. And my point is that if you have a shared reflection on a topic related, say, for example, to Adam, each will be able to produce her or his insights into that topic, into that personality, into the events that are described in the scriptures. And out of those shared insights, it's possible, say you've got a group of four people or most six people, to record those insights. And in recording them, to be able to transcribe them into what I call a tapestry, which is a memory. A tapestry of the different threads coming out of the believers' reflections, Muslim, Christian, to create this tapestry on the memory, for example, of Adam. And in that tapestry, there will be lines and links which each can share with the other, each can affirm. And there will be links and elements where there is difference. And it is trying to put those two together, because the basic truth behind these revelations is the one God, which the Vatican Council affirmed in its document Nostra Aetate as being the one God of Christianity and the one God of Islam. The one God revealing in two voices. The one God's sanctifying in two ways. The one God being remembered as those sanctified sharing their insights together to produce a tapestry of similarity and difference. This is not syncretism, nor is it trying to reach an agreed statement, nor is it intellectual. This is the heart speaking to the heart, inspired by the one God in two different ways. Yes, it's ambitious. Yes, there will be a lot of people, Christian and Muslim, who will say it's impossible, it doesn't represent our tradition, etc. But what cannot be denied is, first, the one God. Second, that the scriptures echo each other. And third, that each of us, Muslim and Christian, is capable of meditating on those scriptures and having insights flowing from that meditation. And so fourthly, what is not disputable is if we share those insights, both of agreement and difference, of echo and counter-echo, there we can create something new, a positive memory, accepting difference, affirming similarity. And in that way, help to dissolve some of the negative memories which are passed down and have been passed down for generations among Christians on the one hand about Islam and among Muslims about Christianity. So that is the core of what this book is trying to say and trying to achieve. Will it succeed? As both Muslim and Christian would say, if it is God's will, it will happen. All I'm trying to do is to propose and to invite. And that is the core of what I'm trying to do. The reason I'm going to the United States is I'm going to a monastery called St. Procopius in Lisle, Illinois, which runs a university called Benedictine University. 25% of the students there are Muslim, so that the Benedictine culture and the Muslim culture coexist in that university. And they've invited me to work there because of the possibility of developing, among those who are interested and in a way that is not trying to push anything against anyone's will, this sort of creative approach to our two spiritualities. So I ask you to pray for that intention.
And that was Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright speaking to Linda Bordoni. And that's all I have time for today. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.